It is something that we rarely talk about with one another. It's a sin. It's a problem. And we rarely talk about it, except perhaps maybe with a counselor or maybe with a close friend. But even with a close friend, an intimate friend, we would be very careful and very selective in who we talk to and how we share this, lest we would be misunderstood. It is a problem that is very prominent in the world, and it's very prominent in the Christian church. It's a personal sin, something that we recognize, but we try to hide. It's a very common sin. It has ruined young people as they've got started in this world. It has got them started on the wrong foot, and it's ruined young girls and young men. It has ruined older people in their lives. It has split churches. It has created a great amount of problems. It's found among the unsaved, and in the Scriptures it's listed among the unsaved very frequently, but it's also listed in the Scriptures as very frequent among believers. It is not just found in young, or not just found in the average, quote, Christian, the pew setter. It's among elders, deacons, preachers, leaders. It exists on a wide scale, and it's difficult to talk about because it's one of the things, if we talk about, obviously when I talk about these things, people are going to say, well, what's bugging old John, or what's he having trouble with? But we're called to open His Word and not always to cater. We're called to share His Word as God puts it on our hearts. Now, the Apostle Paul mentions this problem in 6 different epistles. He mentions it more than 6 times. But it's interesting that he mentions it in 6 different epistles. So it was on his mind, and he mentioned it in certain circumstances. Let me give you an illustration. In one of the books, he mentions it, in the book of Romans, as a sin that is common and frequent in the world and that causes great troubles. But later on in the book, he said it's something that believers should be aware of, we should be warned about. So it is something that he saw as part of the life without Christ, but he sees it as a pitfall for Christians. In another book, he says it causes divisions. Now, if you read that book, well, after I give you these verses, and you read these verses and you meditate on it, it may surprise you that he says it's a cause of division, because the book is dealing with theological problems, and it's dealing with practical problems, and it's dealing with other sorts of problems in the local church. And we think sorting the problem out will help, and of course it will help, but we might be surprised that Paul says behind some of this, not all of it, but behind some of this is this problem. And the same book where he says it causes division, he says a characteristic to sin just opposite of love. In another book, he warns believers about it. In another book, he mentions it twice. It's on the list of the sins of the flesh. But in the same book, at the end of the book, he says, I warn you not to do this to one another. So it's something that Paul saw exists in interesting forms in the Christian life and in the Christian community. In another book, pastor and epistle, he said it's a characteristic of the false teacher. And in another one of his books, Titus, he says it's a common sin, universal among all people. James mentions it 3 times and Peter once. And James gives us a lot of details, and hopefully if this is how the Lord leads, I would like to develop that later on. Now would you please open up Proverbs chapter 14, verse 30. If you already haven't figured it out, those who were there Wednesday night know, but if you already haven't figured it out, the answer is right here. Proverbs 14, 30. A sound heart is life to the body, but envy is rottenness to the bones. Envy. Now what's interesting about this sin of envy is that there are many, many biblical examples. Nave's Topical Bible. This is, by the way, a very, very useful study. Nave's Topical Bible. And Nave's Topical Bible has envy and jealousy as defined, but when it uses illustrations about either envy or jealousy, it uses the very, very same illustration. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to package these words together. I know there's a subtle difference between envy and jealousy, but I'm going to put these together and look at the illustration. And there are many biblical illustrations. And the reason I think so is because this problem in our lives is usually not found out by just doing a word study. And I want you to follow this, because this is important. We can do all the word studies we want, but this sin is usually revealed to us in a practical, everyday situation where we suddenly realize that something is wrong with me. In other words, there are so many biblical illustrations simply because the Lord wants to show us that this sin is usually revealed in relation problems. Something happens and we ask ourselves, whoa, did I act out of character? What's the matter with me? And I begin to see, or I'm embarrassed. And I begin to see there's a problem. So therefore, the Bible has so many illustrations. I'm just going to give you a few and no details. Now I'm going to focus on one. But the Bible has so many illustrations, one believes that God is trying to say, I want you to see how it works. The best way to find out if envy is in your heart is how it works. So this is what we're going to do. It's found in between Cain and Abel, right in the beginning. It's found between Sarah and Hagar in Genesis 16. Sarah and Hagar in the jealousy over the son. Rachel and Leah had this problem. Leah had many children and Rachel did not. And Rachel says, I'll just die if I can. And one heart goes out to this woman who wants to be a mother so badly. And her heart goes out to her. And she looks over at Leah, and it's not Leah's fault. Leah just had children and a relationship with Jacob. But oh my, her heart is burdened and her heart hurts. Joseph and his brothers, we know the story of Joseph and his brothers and how Joseph came in with his dreams and he came in with his the things that he felt God was going to do, and they sold him to Egypt. And the reason we know envy is involved is because Stephen in Acts chapter 7 verse 9 in his sermon, he says it was because of envy they sold him. So Stephen looked back and said the real culprit behind that was envy. It appears in Numbers chapter 12, Miriam and Aaron. And one day they come to Moses and they say to Moses, you know, God speaks to you, that's right, but he also speaks to us. And I think you're taking too much to yourself. But it's interesting. This is an interesting fact, people. But in order to attack Moses, because they were really jealous of his authority, they attacked a weak spot in his life. You know what they did. They said, you married a woman out of our culture. He did. And they attacked it. What they're really saying is, how could a guy who supposedly has so much wisdom marry a woman like that? Well, it's envy. Later on, there was a man by the name of Korah. Chapter 16 of Numbers. And Korah rebels with a couple of their men. And what's interesting about Korah's rebellion is this. Father, there's a little humor here. Aaron's the high priest, and he wants to be like Moses. Korah's a Levite, and he wants to be like Aaron. So Korah comes in, and he wants to be Aaron. He wants the high priest, and Aaron wants to be the high priest and be on the board, so to speak, telling what to do. In other words, I guess we're never satisfied, are we? But it's interesting because Korah wanted this. Now, how do we know Korah is motivated by envy? Sometimes the Bible helps us. Psalm 106, verses 16 and 18 said he was envious. So we get a little insight from the psalmist in regards to Korah and Korah's rebellion. And what's interesting is when Korah came to Moses with these other men and they attacked Moses, Moses immediately stepped back and he looked at Korah and he says, I know what you want. You want to be the high priest. Now that takes some insight, doesn't it? Moses saw right behind all of the humbug about whatever biblical truths Korah was using. I know what you want to be. You want to be the high priest. Wow. So there are many biblical examples, and if you would go to the scriptures or you would go to the topical Bible, you'll find many, many examples. But these examples are there for admonition and learning, because this is the sort of thing that is so subtle, so hidden in our hearts, so easy to deceive us, that unless we're shocked and embarrassed, we may not see it. And then when we're shocked and embarrassed, we want to run for cover, and we need some answers. in Acts chapter 13 and Acts chapter 17, it says one of the reasons some of the people opposed Paul was because you were envious of his success. So the scriptures put a lot of these in, reminding us. These examples there are then so that we can learn through experience. We may learn through failure. We may learn through exposure. But we learn, and when we learn, we have to deal with it. And later on I will talk about, Lord willing, how to deal with it. So the biblical example is the best way to understand it, and the best example is King Saul. Now, King Saul's life is an open book. When you read King Saul's life, it's there on the surface, it's so easy. It says what God is saying here, in your face. If you can't see it here, you'll never see it. It's written all over Saul's life. So we're going to look a little bit at King Saul this morning. So I would ask you to open up to 1 Samuel chapter 18. First Samuel chapter 18. Now, we know that by this chapter, King Saul has developed some bad habits. One of them is he has developed the habit of disobedience. Obedience is hard for him. He's always struggling with obedience. And he's developed this habit of always finding excuse for his disobedience. He is also very much influenced by the fear of man. When you see Saul's disobedience, you often ask yourself why, and you find out it's the fear of man. And then the other thing, because of the fear of man that enters Saul's life, is this problem of envy. This problem of envy. So when you begin to read Saul's life, you understand very clearly that this man's habit of disobedience, his fear of man, is it perhaps a result of envy, and envy begins to work in his heart. Now let me give you some characteristics of envy, some things that I've written down. I'm kind of proud of this. I didn't steal them from coming. I like this. But here are some of the things I'd share with you before we get into Saul's life. When you study Saul's life, or any person whose lives are given under influence by envy, you'll find this, that envy seems to control and influence everything these people do. Seems to control everything and influence everything they do. At first we think it's easily confined to just a little corner of our heart. But as it begins to work, it begins to spread far and wide. So what you have is a control. It begins to control what Saul is doing. It begins to affect everything he does. You can see it begin the trend. And by the end of his life, Saul is totally taken up with this. And everybody he touches, everything he does, is influenced by envy. So it controls and it influences what Saul does. It spills over into everything he does. A little leaven leavens a whole lump. Another thing about envy is that envy is a distortion. And it's a deception. First of all, it deceives us. And this deception gives way to some sort of distortion of other people's lives and the circumstances. Saul looks over at David in chapter 18, I think 8, and it's something he says, I know he wants the throne. So he sees all of David's success, all of David going to war, all of David's obedience in the light of one thing. He's out to get me. He wants the throne. At this time, I don't think David had a very clear concept of it all. So it's a deception. And then this deception, deceiving the heart, gives way to a distortion. One of the things it does, it always makes the person feel they're right. It always makes the person feel that others are wrong. So it deceives, and then it distorts. Other things I wrote down here, after I wrote this down, I realized there's a whole bunch of D's here. It would make a nice four-point outline, say. But the other thing it does, it begins to doubt other people's motives. I wonder what he did that for. You think David once said, how come Jonathan spent so much time with David? I wonder why David went and talked to the priest. I wonder why the priest talked to David. I wonder what's in the priest's mind. Maybe they're conspiring together and so it doubts others' motives. Somebody makes some money, oh, he must be because he wants to be greedy. Really? And somebody writes a book because they want to be famous, and somebody gives this. I don't know. But that's how it works. Attributing to other people sort of thing. So it doubts other people's motives. And it discerns everybody's motives in the light of envy. In other words, you become so convinced of what you believe that it becomes a habit, it becomes second nature, that you are convinced that others are wrong and you're right. Now, some of this I'm telling you is because I've struggled with some things. There have been some illustrations in my life, and I'm going to go back to early days. When I go back to the early days and tell you a story, it doesn't mean I have a handle on it. It doesn't mean I've never had the problem before, but it does mean that I tried to build in my life a system of biblical thought to deal with it, because it was frightening when I first discovered it. It was a small thing. I was saved a little while. I was working in Youth for Christ in Pennsylvania. I was in boot camp, and two of us were working Youth for Christ Bible Club. We had good Bible club. Doing good job. The guy I was working with, his name was John, and John had been to a Bible school before, and then got sick and had to drop out. He went to sea for a year to recover his health, and he came into the boot camp, so he was a talented man, and he was gifted, and we worked together. And the kids liked John better than they liked me. John was better at it. Now, it didn't make any difference at first, but I noticed that how the kids would respond to John. I was slowly starting to get irritable, which my wife probably would shake her head and say, slowly. Anyway, slowly started getting irritable. When my Friday night came to speak, we would alternate Friday nights. One Friday night I got up, and I really tried to jam the truth, and I mean I was ready to go. I raised the roof with my preaching, and it was really bad. See? And the next day after work detail, I took a walk, and I really felt upset. Now, I attribute this to the Lord, and again, I don't mean to say it's never come again. I'm going to use one way back so you don't worry about what I do these days. But I took a walk in the Alleghenies, and if you love the mountains, from a city boy walking the Alleghenies, what a place. And while I was praying, all of a sudden it hit me. It just came to me. You're envious, John. Wow. Now, what happened right after that was a total sense of desperation in my life. No joke. I just thought, oh, man. Because suddenly I thought, how are you going to deal with this? And the other thing I thought of, Ducky, if you don't deal with this thing, it's going to crop up again and again and again and again and ruin you. You must find a way to take care of it. But I remember taking a walk that afternoon and just feeling totally empty and helpless. Because it's a sin of the heart and deceiving. Well, I built my little system. In my area of preaching, I go to build my system from 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and 3 and other things. And I built my way of trying to go through biblical truth. So early on. Now, it obviously was in my life before then, but I never thought about it. But from early on, I became aware that this could really ruin relationship. And it could really hurt my life with the Lord. And then as the years have gone by, and I've had troubles with it off and on, I've taken my little theological system and tried to use it as best I could. So it creates this sort of thing. It creates doubts, and we discern all other people's sins in the light of this. Once he is convinced, he acts upon his motives. Now, so there are two things before we get into Saul. One, it is difficult to discern. Number two, it's difficult to deal with. It's hard. It can be for some of us a whole lifelong of thought patterns until we're overwhelmed by the task of having God take it from us, just like some other sin. So it is difficult to discern, and it is difficult to deal with. Here are some things I feel are important before we go into Saul's life. Here's some questions you should ask yourself. Now, there are a lot more questions you could write down. I'm sure you could, but here's what you should ask yourself. How do I know if any action I take is really motivated by envy or a proper motive? How do I know? How do I know that? You see, envy can look right. Envy can stand on truth and principle. It can take a firm stand and yet desire and think about the other person is wrong. Now, why do I say that? How else could it split a church? How else could envy split a church? It was split in Corinth because this guy had a gift and that guy had a gift and Paul is better and Peter's better. I speak in tongues and I'm a prophet and I do this. How else could it split a church? That had to split a church in practical ways where people stood on a principle, adamant on a principle. Now, we're supposed to stand on principles, but the idea of standing on it was to defeat that person, to get your position. Otherwise, how could it split a church? How could it be divisive? It has to work in a channel, in such a way that it looks good and it's suspicious of the actions and the motives of other people. Otherwise, I feel, why would Paul ask that? Another question to ask is, how do I know when I pointed out an error in someone's life or maybe exposed a failure or a wrong use of Scripture that envy isn't the motivation? Think about it. How do I know that? Well, it's not always the reason, obviously, but it must be able to sometimes do that. Here's another one I wrote. And this is something that I watch and I say, why am I irritable with this person and situation? Why did it bother me so much? I've gone home from meetings and I've been bothered. What the big deal? There's nothing there, Ducky. Nothing. It won't ruin anything. And I wonder, why do I perhaps in some situations speak out so strongly, so out of character? Boy, that was a hard thing to say. Whoa. That's not like you, Ducky. See? Whoa. Well, sit down and think a little bit. Why do I want this proposal that she or he give to be defeated? Well, I don't want my way. Now, I'm not saying envy is behind all of that. No. But the consideration we have to give is that it might be in some of that. So it is difficult to discern. It is difficult to deal with. Now in chapter 18, let's look at a few things. I'm going to go through this quickly because you can read this at home. I urge you to read it. You'll find it very interesting. But envy here is all over the pages of this. You read books of quotes. One of the most prolific writers is a man by the name of Unknown. And what his name is, Herman or John Unknown. But anyway, Unknown said this. Okay, here's what Unknown said. Envy grows in the shadow of another's success. All right? Say it again. Envy grows in the shadow of another's success. And that's what was my problem with John Seiler. It grew in the shadow of success. David is popular. Chapter 18, verse 7. David, Saul is slaying his thousands. David is 10,000s. All right? So David is now popular, and Saul is watching this. David has successful achievements. He goes out to war, and everything that Saul asked him to do, you can read this here. Everything he asked him to do, he did, and he did well. He did well. He just didn't go out and do it. He did it well. David was a man of personal excellence, and David went out, verse 5, and wherever Saul sent him, and behaved wisely. And Saul sent him over the man of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people in the sight of Saul. So behave wisely. And later on, you'll see that there are other phrases that Saul knew. Verse 28. And Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David. And Saul becomes more and more irritated. More and more irritated. More and more reason for being suspicious of David. More and more reason for wanting David to be removed. So envy grows in the shadow of another's success. Saul's reaction, verses 8 and 9 of chapter 18. And Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000, and to me they have ascribed only 1,000. What more can he want now but the kingdom? David's doing a good job, and he says, I know why he's doing a good job for only one reason. He went, my job. You know, it's my play. That's why. But notice what it did to Saul. He was angry, and it displeased him. The word for anger here in the Hebrew means to burn within. One paraphrase said, Saul did a slow burn. Slow burn. And then the word displeased means inner turmoil. Inner turmoil. So what was happening to Saul, he was burning within, and it was creating an inner civil war. One of the translations says his stomach turned. See, he did a slow burn and his stomach turned. I kind of like those modern things. You can see then how it affected him. It begins to work in his life and begins to eat away at him. So Saul has looked at what David has done. And as Saul's fear grows, his intensity grows, he becomes more paranoid and more suspicious of people around him, their actions and their motives. And he becomes destructive. Now there's a cast of characters in the story. And let me bring the scene first. If you were writing a movie, you have Jonathan and David. You have this friendship. Now, of course, we know that who Jonathan was, Saul's son. And yet he formed a wonderful relationship with David. Saul couldn't take it. You're either with me or you're not with me, but that's it. Jonathan and David form a relationship. Then there's Saul and his daughters. He said, the man who killed the giant Goliath, I will give my daughter. David kills him, and he says, you'll get my daughter. But David had no dowry. He was from a poor family. So when David is going out to kill to get his dowry, Saul does a little switcheroo and marries the oldest daughter to somebody else and brings in the little palace cutie pie. That's the way I describe Michael, unfortunately. The little palace cutie pie who had a crush on David and said, Daddy, I can't live without him. So I'll set him up. And I'd tell you one thing, if I set him up, he'll have his hands full. See? So he sets him up. He goes back on his word. David risks his life. All right, so you have Saul and his daughters. Then you have a priest who serves the Lord, doing his job, Ahimelech. He's doing his job. I know there was no tabernacle, the ark isn't there. Some things are in a stated room, but this was still a good man trying to do what God called him to do. And when you read the chapter when David goes, sees him, here's David, and here's also one of Saul's henchmen, and he's faithfully serving both. Now he's going to lose his life because Saul can't take it. So this man's life is involved. And then you have the fact that Saul alienates his soldiers. Constantly alienates his soldiers. So let's look at this a little bit in detail. All right. Jonathan, of course, was loyal to his father. Jonathan had gone to war and he was loyal to his father and he stuck with his father. He died with his father. But he formed a unique relationship with David, and in David he saw the abilities that David had and what God was doing, and he knew that David was going to have the throne. And I like Jonathan. I like Jonathan because in Jonathan there's absolutely no wounded pride. I like him. He looks over and he sees David and he knows what David's going to be, and he makes a covenant with David and he defends David, but he loves his father and he spends his time with his father. But his father can't take that. You're with me or you're not. So David and Jonathan form a good friendship. And in chapter 19, verse 2, Jonathan comes and says to David, my father wants to kill you. And therefore, please be on your guard till morning and stay in a secret place. So Jonathan comes and tells David. And then in verses 4 to 6, Jonathan goes talk to his father. Now, watch this. Jonathan talks to his father. Thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father. Verse 4, chapter 19, and said, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good toward you. For he took his life into his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought him a great deliverance to all Israel. You saw it, and rejoice. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause? Verse 6. So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed. Jonathan is a believing person. says, I'll go talk to my father. And he pleaded with his father. And Saul says, you're right, son. I won't kill David. So verse 8 says, it says later on that David went home. He went back to the palace. He did. He went to war. And he went out and he just went back. Okay, I'll accept Saul's word. And Jonathan accepted it. Jonathan was trusting. He believed his father. He pleaded with his father. Told his father the truth. But Saul is the kind of man that as he sits down and thinks about this, it starts turning in his stomach again. And so he tries to kill David by throwing a spear, and David flees. When David and Jonathan meet the next time, there's tension. You know, David and Jonathan's relationship was tested severely. Because when Jonathan came and talked to David, David says, I know your father wants to kill me. No, he kept his word. Look, I know it. And there was some tension. And Jonathan backed off and said, look, let's take a walk and talk. Here's what we'll do. Here's what we're going to do. It could have broken a relationship there. Because David was beginning to wonder a little bit about Jonathan. So David and Jonathan make a plan. David doesn't want to go to the banquet. So they make a plan, and Jonathan goes into the banquet. And after one day at this banquet, Saul says, where's David? Oh, he's probably out. He'd been playing around. He needs to purify himself before he comes to this. And then the second day he says to Jonathan, where's David? And Jonathan says, look, his family has a reunion this time of the year. They like to celebrate this Christmas feast together. So he's over there with his family. And Saul begins to think, ain't so. Something's wrong. So he begins to believe that his son is involved in this. And what Saul does is expose himself. Envy comes to the surface. And let's read in chapter 20, verse 28. So Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please let me go. Our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now I have found favor in your eyes. Please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he has not come to the king's table. And Saul was angry, and we know that Saul swears at his son. He damages the relationship. Saul was angry. And not only does he swear to his son, verse 33, he cast a spear to kill him. And in verse 34, it says, Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger. You see what Saul's envy did? Saul's envy spilled over, and now it created anger in David and in Jonathan. The people around us will feel it. The people around us will know it. The people around us will suffer under it. Now, Jonathan is mad, and he gets up and he walks out. Saul's driven him away. All right? And it's a pathetic thing because Jonathan will die with his father. So Jonathan was angry, and he goes and tells David. Right? And so Saul has driven away his son. In his anger and his envy, he demands total loyalty. And Jonathan gets up and leaves. But Jonathan still will die with him. Okay, now let's go to David and his wife, Michal, chapter 19. In chapter 19, remember again, David marries Michal, and he comes home, and the spy network has told her that Saul is going to send people to kill him. And she said to David in chapter 19, starting at verse 11, Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. So there are spies sitting in cars or chariots or on the block and whatever they do, watching this. And the daughter gets hint of this, and she says to David that my father is going to kill you, and you must escape. So verse 12. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. And she put an image in the bed and made it look like he was there. And of course, the messengers came in, and Saul finally came. Verse 17. And Saul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped? Talk about deception. He's a deceiver himself. Now he's worried about somebody else's deception. Why did you see me like this? This is what she said. And Michal answered Saul. He said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you? So David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah. Now what the daughter does is this. She doesn't have the courage John does. Jonathan says, Daddy, why you out to get him? What are you going to kill him for? She lies. Now, on the surface, it looks good, except for two things. She misrepresents her husband. And let me put it vice versa. Never misrepresent your spouse, husband or wife. She misrepresents him. And what does she say? He's going to kill me. You know what she's saying? Daddy, he's an abuser. Now, I know, don't modernize it, but it's true. He's a violent man. That's all Saul needs. She protects his life, but not his honor. And husbands and wives, we need to protect each other's honor. Do not misrepresent your spouse. Say. So what she does, she saves his life, but she's given Saul one more reason to follow after David and kill him. Say, I told you all along. Look what he's gonna what's gonna do to my darling little sweetie pie here. Beat her up. Kill her. She doesn't have the courage to stand like Jonathan. But the issue is this. Notice what envy did. It took this daughter and it brought her under the influence of his envy. Right? And in the influence of his envy, it does something to her character. Everybody who comes in contact with him is touched one way or the other. So this daughter misrepresents David. She may have regarded his life, but she didn't regard his honor. And husbands and wives, we need to beware. Do not misrepresent your spouse in public. Do not misrepresent them. Do not just protect the pocketbook and not their honor. She's no good. She's no good. And it proved to be that way later on in their relationship. She's no good. She doesn't have the honesty, but Saul, again, manifests in her heart the problem. Now, we'll skip over to chapter 22. David had gone to Samuel, and word got out that he went to Samuel, so David had to flee, and now David goes to the priest. And in chapter 22, verses 6 to 19, and David goes to the priest, he's gathered a group of men, people who are starting to join him, and they're coming together to meet with David, and he goes to the priest Ahimelech, and he's looking for some encouragement. And of course, David goes, and the priest seems to think something's not in the up and up, and unfortunately, David lies to him. David lies to him. See? The priest doesn't think things are quite right. But they've, no. Here's, I'm here because I have to do this. The king sent me. But the priest knows. What's he asking for bread for, and what's he asking for a weapon for if the king sent him? He should have food, and he should have plenty of swords. But the priest is a good man. Ahimelech's a good man, and he begins to encourage David. He wants to help David. He's involved with David. So David looks to the priest for help. And he's looking for the priest to help him. And everything is all right, except there's another man there called Doeg. And he's there, and he belongs to Saul. Now, you know the story. Later on, the man goes back and tell Saul. Now in chapter 22, the first part of it, there's something else I want to point out, because it's interesting that David also is suspicious of his men. let's look in verses chapter 22. Verse 7. And Saul said to his servants, this is why David was with the king, by the way, this is one of the things, what meanwhile back at the ranch, sort of thing. All verse 7. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you captains over his thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse." Now his soldiers, his troops, and what does he say? "You conspired against me. You haven't told me." Well, maybe they didn't know. But there are two things here about Saul that I think are interesting. In this conspiracy, he bases his appeal to these men to be loyal to him on two things. "I can make you wealthy and give you a position." Is David going to give you vineyards like I'm going to give you? Is he going to make you all captains and leaders? He appeals to the loyalty and base things. "You'll get a better pay, and I'll give you a promotion." See, you follow me. That's what he's saying. So you have this problem. Well, as the priest has found out, the priest defends David. The priest comes over, and you can look in chapter 22, and you can see how he defends David. He defends David, and verse 18, he is killed, but he says, look, there's nobody been faithful. It's faithful to you. And I'm a priest, and he came to me, and I did what I have to do, and David has been loyal. You know what envy did? Maybe I'm modernizing this, but envy ruined the ministry of a man. The king, Ahimelech. The priest, Ahimelech. It ruined his ministry. He was there to serve. And when you serve everybody, not just your little group. You serve who God brings across your path. See? You do that. And he killed them. Envy ruined a godly man's life. How many full-time workers around America because of our past problem, the assembly, have their ministries ruined, not just because of truth, but because of envy? I'd like to know. I think this score is higher than we really know. So envy is blind to the actual facts. Saul is blinded. When Jesus did a miracle, he healed the blind. Remember, he healed the blind, and Jesus did the miracle, and instead of the Pharisees coming in and saying, whoa, he healed the blind, they said, well, he probably did it under the power of Satan. He probably saying. They can't even see the marvelousness of it. They have to attribute to Jesus Christ the wrong motive. Well, sure he did, but he's probably under some weird power of the enemy. That's how blind it is. It can never attribute where good and the Spirit of God is working. And so these men come in and they say these things. And Matthew did it by the power of Satan. What envy does is misinterpret facts as they are. All right? It leads to attributing base motives to others. David went to throne. That's why he's serving me. He did it under the power of Satan. Base motives. Why did he do that? Attribute base motives. David wants the throne. The soldiers are conspiring against me. Jonathan is disloyal to me. The priest shouldn't have been there to help David. See? And so this becomes a problem. It made him upset. You read this. You look at his life. There was no joy. There was no hope. There was only suspicion. And it caused him to do and say foolish things. Thrust the spirit at David. Swear at his son. Kill a priest. Mistrust and malign his troops. Alienate people. That's why God has given us Saul. Why so much about Saul? You realize there's an incredible amount of information about Saul. And when you read it, it just jumps out of the page at you. God wants us to see this for admonition and warning, because this is how something negative can work in our lives. Jealousy and envy. So he seeks to kill him. Now today I've given you a biblical illustration. A clear one. Next time, Lord willing, I'd like to go a little deeper to our hearts. How it works. This is easy today. Because it's on the surface pages of the Bible, it's easy. But James deals with it in chapter 3 and in chapter 4. And I'd like to, Lord willing, if I can have the insight and the courage to do this, I'd like to be able to deliver some thoughts on how it works in our hearts. We've just seen how it works in Saul, because it cannot be hid. Alienates his son, his daughter, the high priest, his troops, suspicious of everyone around. And everybody who comes under his influence and sphere is tested to act a certain way. That is a terrible thing. His envy spread over and spilled over. It is a painful thing. And the Lord help us to understand this. I am not saying it is behind all of our problems. Not saying behind all of our church split. No. I'm not saying it's behind every little thing we do. But one of the things that I think is noticeable is spoken about so many times and mentioned so many times that I think it's worthy to pay attention to. But how do we find this out? As I said, difficult to discern. Usually through something we do that all of a sudden makes us say, whoa, what's going on here? Father, thank you for your word. All of these things from your word have been given to us for our admonition and learning. The good things, the bad things. when we look at this person of the king of King Saul, we see clearly and plainly on the pages of the Bible, we don't need profound theological study to understand this. It is there. The man was angry. He was displeased. And it began to show in his life until every good thing was touched or hurt or destroyed. And Father, help us. We never know when it'll come. We never know what our motive is. And it's painful when we discover that we may be acting under a principle other than a principle we hold. Help us to see how it affects our kids, our wives, our husbands, the people around us, the people in the church we serve with, the people who serve on a committee with us or do something. Help us to see how it may be lying under the surface of our lives and actually cause us to act or decide a certain way so that people can be kept in their place. Father, we know that envy is far more inclusive than this. It has to do with wealth and position and happiness and what we get out of life. And so help us in the days ahead, should you lay it on my heart to develop this. Help me to be able to develop the thoughts that we might watch our hearts and understand how this gets into our hearts and what the answer is. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.